what if land belonged to us all?
How if Scotland is no longer belonging to one person, but is now belonging to many? And this movement is happening with government support, one might say government pressure, all over Scotland. So Scotland will at long last, for good or ill, be owned by communities rather than by individuals. Land belongs to us all. It is our mother. We are here to superintend it, to love it. It helps us. We should help it. And common ownership advances that kind of thinking.
That's Simon Winchester. We spend most of the hour talking with him about his fascinating book, Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. Then we revisit part of an interview with one of the people Winchester talks about in Land, Isabella Tree. She tells us of the land she's rewilded. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Land, whether meadow or mountainside, parkland or pasture, suburb or city, it's central to our existence. It quite literally underlies and underpins everything. In his new book, Land, Simon Winchester examines what we human beings are doing and have done with the billions of acres that together make up the solid surface of our planet. He looks at how we acquire land, how we steward it, how and why we fight over it, and finally, how we can come to share it. Simon Winchester is the author of more books than I can count. Among them are the best-selling The Professor and the Madman, Pacific, and A Crack in the Edge of the World. We've spoken with Winchester about the last two previously on Writer's Voice. Simon Winchester, welcome back to Writer's Voice. It's been a long time, and I'm so thrilled to be talking with you again.
Well, me too. It's been a while, but thank you for having me.
So now you have a very distinct voice, and it's really, I have to say, it's a pleasure to inhabit the hallways of your mind. This is your 15th nonfiction book, is that correct?
Something like that. I mean, I think the total is sort of rather vulgarly sort of 32 or something, but a lot of them fell by the wayside before The Professor and the Madman in 98. And then since then, they've become somewhat more apparent. But there were books before then, and of course, such is the way with publishing that old books from years ago that were deemed not tremendously popular were suddenly reconfigured and reissued and have done reasonably well. So now I think it's 31 or 32.
Wow, that's amazing. We've talked with you before about oceans. You've written about the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean in two different books. You've written about volcanoes, earthquakes, scientists of various sorts. Now, land. What guides you in picking your subjects?
Well, a variety of things, really. Sometimes one book leads naturally to another. I mean, for instance, back in the days of The Professor and the Madman, my editor, the late, beloved and long lamented Larry Ashmead, said what characterizes this book is a series of criteria. Can you think of anybody else that has those same criteria? And weren't you once a geologist? And that led me from writing about W.C. Minor and the making of the Oxford English Dictionary to a chap called William Smith and the construction of the first geological map of anywhere. And that geology book, I think, led to Krakatoa because someone said, well, why don't we see if there are any more stories from geology? And that led to the San Francisco earthquake. So a variety of things. In this particular case, the land book came about largely because of a breakfast time discussion my wife and I were having about immigration, of all things, and the thought that an awful lot of the people that came to this country in the 1700s came because they'd been dispossessed of their land in England because of these newfangled laws that have collectively come to be known as the clearances. And that got us thinking, or what is ownership? What were the clearances? What did ownership mean? And so, very long-winded reply to your question, but basically a variety of reasons, but normally a discussion followed by a light going off. I wonder if that might be a good subject for a book.
Well, this is really a fascinating book, and we will talk about the clearances and the enclosure movement. But you start this book out, Simon Winchester, you start land out with your own little patch of land, with buying your own first little patch of land. Tell us about it.
It's in Dutchess County, New York. Basically, when I'd lived in Hong Kong for 13 years, from 85 to 97. And when I decided, because it had been handed over, it was no longer a British colony. And so the story of what would happen when it became rightly back in Chinese hands, the story was effectively done for the time being. So where might I go and live? And I could have gone and lived either in Britain, where I come from, or the United States, where I'd been a correspondent. And the New York Times correspondent in Hong Kong at the time, a chap called Larry Zuckerman, said that if I lived in New England, I'd had all the sort of attractiveness of the English countryside combined with all the go and get 'em enthusiasm of the American people. So I thought that was sound and logical. So I came over here and bought a little cottage in a town called Wassaic in Dutchess County, the end, as it happens, of the railway line from Grand Central northwards. And that land, it just had a few acres, but it was surrounded by a much larger tract of forested land that its owner, who was a plumber from the Bronx, a man called Caesar Luria, used to come up each season and hunt for deer. And he was a very kind, nice man. And he would always leave me a cooler with venison and usually a bottle of cognac to thank me for any disturbance he might have caused. He never caused any, but it's a way of saying thank you. And then he came to me one year and said, quite honestly, he paid taxes on this land, but he only came up two or three times a year. So maybe I'd like to buy it. It wasn't much use to him, and it surrounded my house. And I thought, yes, and he named a price. So all of a sudden I own 100 and I think it was about 140 acres. It wasn't very useful land. It was mostly on the north facing side of a mountain. So it was mostly sloping. There were a couple of little rivers, but beautiful trees, oak and ash and pine, of course, in abundance, and lots of wildlife, deer, of course, but also, you know, raccoons and possums and rabbits. And I was enchanted by it, but didn't think in depth about it until 2011, when I became a citizen of this country and took the oath on the afterdeck of the USS Constitution in Boston Harbor. And I found the ceremony, as most people who immigrate to this country do, intensely moving. And it suddenly occurred to me that I was now, because of the ownership of this land, quite literally invested in the country of which I'd just become a citizen. So I became more interested in it and would go. By this time, I had moved up to more sensible, in other words, horizontal land up in Massachusetts. But I had kept, not the cottage, but I had kept the land in Dutchess County. And I would go down and visit it. And then I was sort of amazed, awed, if you like, at the concept of owning. I mean, that I would fall to my knees, if you like, I'm not sure that I ever did that, but sift the soil through my fingers and think, I own this, I own that tree, and that rabbit is on my property. So I started looking into the history of who had owned it before me. Obviously, Mr. Luria, and who he had bought it from, and way back into but the records are extremely good, back into the 20th century, 19th, 18th, then they became handwritten records, and then they became ragged and often indecipherable, but all the way back to the early part of the 17th century, when the documents were written not in English, but in Dutch. And they were the indications that the first explorers of this land, European explorers, that is, had been Hollanders, led by Henry Hudson, of course, although he was British, he was leading in 1609 a Dutch expedition. And they would take land from the people who lived there. And these people, the documents were still to be found in the archives, which showed a flourish of a Dutch signature and then an X or a little sketch of a deer or some antlers or something like that, which was the mark made by the people from whom the Dutchman took this land. And these were the Mohican Indians. Had it been further south, it would have been the Lenape. Further north, it would have been the Iroquois, the Mohawk. But these were the Mohican. And in common with most, so far as my research showed, anyway, most Native Americans, the Mohican had never had the concept of ownership. They'd used the land, they'd superintended it, they'd harvested it, and in very sophisticated ways, it should be said. They had hunted on it, they had tended to it, but they had never thought of owning it. I mean, the idea was, I wouldn't say repugnant to them, but they'd never really conceived it. You could no more own the land than you could own the breeze or you could own the ocean. And yet I did, and Mr. Luria did, and people in the 19th century did. So what had happened? What did this concept of ownership mean? And I said to my editor in New York, it sounds like something which could be a book. And she said, yes, but not if you restrict it to the United States alone. This was back in the day, 3 years ago, when one could travel, if you remember those such heady times. And so she said, travel, go and have a look all around the world and see what ownership means and has meant. And then you can write a book about it. And so I did. And I went off to Polynesia and Australia, New Zealand, all over Europe, Britain, where I came from, and of course, all over the United States. And the book is the result.
And the book is Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. We're talking with author Simon Winchester. So this concept of ownership, as you pointed out, there's a real difference between the concept of ownership that the Native Americans had, the Mohicans, the people who lived on originally on the land that you ended up buying, and the settlers. You know, we can talk about settler colonialism really all over the world. And the idea of land ownership versus the use of land was also true of New Zealand. And you really tell an amazing story about the Maori, because there is a question now who the land belongs to, the settlers or the Maori. So give us the overview of that story and then tell us what's going on today.
New Zealand is the most recently settled by anyone that is part of the world. I mean, the Polynesians, who are now the Maori, who occupy it now, only came in the 1300s, 1400s, so 700 years of human occupation. And quite happily and contentedly, Captain Cook was the first to, quote, discover, unquote, them. And it was interesting to note that when he left England on this great expedition in which he went to Australia and all over Polynesia and New Zealand, that he was specifically charged by his patron not to take any of the lands anywhere. These belong to the people who already live there. It's often thought that Cook was a sort of an instigator of settler colonialism. In fact, he wasn't. He was there sort of intellectually more, and particularly Joseph Banks, the botanist who went with him, to see who the people were and how interesting and sophisticated they were in their manner of civilization, manner of living. It's almost an anthropological expedition. But anyway, it didn't lead to that sort of thing. It led to white men coming initially from France and then from England to say, gosh, this is beautiful countryside. Let's be having it, if you like. And the concept, basically the legal concept, was that if you come across a chunk of territory anywhere in the world and there are no people there, then it is regarded in law as being terra nullius, to use the Latin phrase, land that belongs to no one. And so you can take it. But of course, there were people in New Zealand, there were people in Australia, there were people in North America. But the sort of intellectual conceit of the settler colonialists was that they may have looked like people, but they weren't people. Particularly, I mean, let's go back for a moment to Native Americans. I dedicate the book to this Ponca chief, magnificent man called Standing Bear, who, highly sophisticated, intelligent man, who went to the Supreme Court in 1879 and said, I want to be declared to be, with all my brothers and sisters, a human being entitled to the civil rights that other human beings on this continent are afforded. And the Supreme Court, in a landmark decision, said, yes, Native Americans are human beings at long last, because hitherto, justifying this concept of terra nullius, they were regarded as groundhogs or rabbits or whatever, officially, legally. I might add that it wasn't until the 1920s that Native Americans were given the vote, which still, considering that this is, quote, their country. But anyway, back to New Zealand, much the same thing was happening. The early settlers were these Maori and didn't, in law, regard them as human beings. And so in 1840, when it was decided officially this should become British territory, the famous or infamous Treaty of Waitangi was signed, a little village up in the North Island of New Zealand. And various, I think it was about 60, representatives of different Maori families and tribes came and signed the document. And then British colonial officials spent 6 months wandering around the country getting others to sign this document. And that became the basis of New Zealand, because then that document said all the land which hitherto had been property of or was superintended or inhabited by the Maori now belonged to Queen Victoria, far away, a woman who never went to New Zealand, but she owned New Zealand. Well, that essentially obtained most of New Zealand's history until the mid-1970s, when this formidable lady, her name is spelled Wiener Cooper, but it's actually pronounced Wiener Cooper. In her early 80s, a Maori woman led a campaign which actually resulted in a march from the very far northern peninsula of the North Island down to the capital in Wellington, saying, this is ridiculous. We want our land back. And oddly enough, or perhaps not oddly because of the nature of the New Zealand government at the time, the government said, let's talk about it. In other words, didn't take the same attitude that Americans have or Canadians have or Australians have, which said, sorry, you missed the boat. It's our land now. And so two bodies were set up, the Maori Land Court and the Waitangi Tribunal, and hearings have been held now since the 1970s and 1980s that have resulted in substantial tracts of land, notably a lot of the New Zealand seashore, being given back to its original, quote, owners, unquote. And so in that sense, New Zealand is providing a model which all of us in settler colonial societies should, in my view, look at, because there has been no sort of revolutionary upset in the fabric of New Zealand as a country. It is one of the happiest countries on earth. But what have they done? When I first went there it must have been the 1980s, I suppose, it was like England set in the South Seas. It was all afternoon tea and lawn bowls and cricket, daffodils. It was, the national anthem was God Save the Queen. It was England. But now the country's name, just its name, has changed. It's New Zealand, yes, but also Aotearoa. Aotearoa is the Polynesian word, land of the long white cloud, because when you saw it from the canoes, it was a long white cloud over it. So Aotearoa / New Zealand, the New Zealand national anthem, God Defend New Zealand, first verse of which is sung not in English, but in Maori. All the road signs are in Maori now, and the Maoris are getting their land back. It seems an absolutely ideal situation, not the kind of situation which would find favour here in the United States, as I know, and perhaps we can talk about that in a second, to my cost here in Massachusetts, because the attempts to give land back to its original owners are resisted fiercely here.
Yes, they are. But, you know, it is interesting that, you know, it's becoming more and more customary. And we just heard this the other day, in fact, at Deb Haaland's confirmation hearing, to refer to the ancestral owners of the land we're on. For example, when I participate in, let's say, organizing meetings of the Long Island Climate Justice Group, you know, I introduce myself as living on Montaukett land. And that's becoming more and more of a convention, which is perhaps just the beginning, and hopefully it will not just end there, but just the beginning of an awareness that this land was not ours originally.
I really hope you're right. I mean, I'm for my sins, moderator of this little town, Sandysfield in the Berkshires. And I am an elected official, so I mean, I'm up for election again in May. Every time I begin the town meeting, or when we have the occasional special town meeting, the same thing, Pledge of Allegiance, which of course, being an Englishman, I had to learn. But then immediately afterwards, say to the people who are all sort of beginning to sit down, I said, no, please remain standing for a moment while we remember that these lands originally are the lands of the Mohican people, and that we should respect their ultimate sovereignty, and that we are there here as their guests. And at first, there was a great deal of resistance, but not enough for me to be defeated the next time I ran. So I think you're absolutely right. This is gaining some traction, particularly in the Northeast. Whether it'll gain traction in, let's say, Oklahoma, center, if you like, of white entitlement and a disdain for Indian claims, I don't know. But I think you're absolutely right. It's a start. And we should thank New Zealand for who have done this as a matter of course for the last 20 years. I think New Zealand and Australia bear some responsibility for it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Simon Winchester about his latest book, Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. Now, as you said, you are from England, as is obvious from your accent as well. And the British Isles is one place that you go. You know, it's very interesting that you go through the different kinds, or the evolution, let's say, of ownership. And I don't want to go all the way back, but let's go back to the Doomsday Book, because this was the first, you know, the first accounting of land ownership in the British Isles. Is that right?
Certainly was. It was essentially a tax register, and a beautiful document. It's two massive books, Little Doomsday and Great Doomsday, still in the National Archive in Kew in southwest London. And it's a wonderful thing to behold. And also to, I mean, I can find, for instance, the village where my parents lived in called Preston in Rutland, in a little county in the middle. And the village in Dorset, where I grew up, a village called Simmonsbury. They're all there with names of families that you can make out. I mean, the writing is somewhat difficult to decipher. But some of them, for instance, Wetfield, I remember, still a prominent name in Simmonsbury to this day, that was existing in the 11th century. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the charm I find in England, anyway, is that people, at least landowners, and this goes to the heart of the problem in a way, have remained essentially, have stayed put for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And it's the dispossessed English people that are the ones that, if you like, shaped the modern world, to use part of the subtitle of the book, because basically all land, when we're talking at a local level, all land in England in, let's say, the 1500s, was owned collectively. You'd have a little village like Simmonsbury that I was mentioning, and it would maybe have 30 little thatched cottages, and those cottages would surround or be surrounded by fields, open fields. And on those fields, all the villagers would raise their animals, be them sheep or cattle or pigs, and grow their turnips or their sprouts or whatever they like to eat. And that was the way that agriculture and society was organized until sometime in the 15th century, when the population was beginning to accelerate in growth, and people began to realize that this wasn't the most efficient way to grow food. Far better to take the common land and put up fences or hedges or ditches and say, this piece of land can be superintended by Mr. A, Mr. Stretfield, let's say, and he can raise his cattle in a scientifically rigorous way, and this fellow can do his pigs, and this fellow can do his turnips, because if not, in common land, the cattle would trample the wheat, the pigs would eat the turnips, and so there was what was called the tragedy of the commons. The commons wouldn't work. And so, beginning in 1604, oddly enough, also in Dorset, in a little village called Radipole, close to where I used to live, Parliament, all the authority of the Parliament in London, said the land in Radipole, the common land, is going to be enclosed. That's the word. The Enclosures Act 1604, relating to Radipole in Dorset, will be enacted. And so a bill was tacked to the church door, and people were invited to read it and object if they needed to. And if not, after 3 months, all the land that had hitherto been common land would now be privately owned. And this did have an enormously beneficial effect on agriculture. It was repeated something like 5,000 times, such that by the middle of Victoria's reign, most of England was privately owned, and lots of cattle, lots of sheep, lots of turnips, lots of pigs, tons of food, everyone's bellies were full and so forth. But it meant that those people who were no longer able, because they didn't own the land, to graze their cattle or their pigs or grow their turnips, were quite literally dispossessed. And so they became, understandably, grumpy about it. And what did they do? They felt they couldn't remain in the countryside any longer. They would trek off to the nearest cities that were beginning to swell. They wouldn't really begin to grow exponentially until the Industrial Revolution, which began in 1776, the same year that America became the United States. And then, you know, they would go to Manchester or Birmingham or Liverpool or Glasgow or wherever and forsake the country forever. Or a substantial number of them thought, why don't we try our fortune overseas? And so they got into ships and headed either west or to the south, either to the Antipodes, Australia and New Zealand, or to North America. And the irony is that they went over imbued with the idea of private land ownership. They had been dispossessed because of this new idea that land could be privately owned. So they arrived here, saw people who they regarded as not being people at all, and immediately set about dispossessing them, thereby forming the basis, with all the troubles attendant on it, of settler colonialism. So I'm afraid, as with so much in the world today, much blame attaches to the British.
And that's so interesting, because I really grew up with a different idea of the enclosure movement. You know, not to say that yours isn't true, but there's another side to it. I mean, I remember Jonathan Swift talking about how sheep eat men, because what you did have in the enclosure movement also was the throwing off of the serfs from their land, dispossessing them of their rights, and the big landowners enclosing the land in order to raise sheep for the textile trade. I mean, this was all part of the development of the Industrial Revolution. And when he said sheep eat men, it was the idea that you had people who literally were starving because they no longer had access to their land. I mean, something like this also happened with the Scottish clearances, but the enclosure movement in England has also been charged with this.
You're absolutely right, and I'm glad you brought up the Highland clearances, because they were cruelty beyond belief, where the most notorious, of course, practitioner of enclosures was, oddly enough, an Englishman, the first Duke of Sutherland, way, way up in the very far north of Scotland. He was a man who had made his fortune in building canals, who was sort of a part of the Industrial Revolution. And he then married the Countess of Sutherland and became the Duke, had this huge Italianate castle called Dunrobin Castle, and then, exactly as you say, set about dispossessing his tenant farmers, the Crofters, who inhabited this vast estate, the biggest landed estate in Europe at the time. We're talking about the beginning of the 19th century, 1815, 1820, and saying these people produce, yes, we live off their rent, but their rents are as nothing compared to textile industry is growing, people need wool, food, they produce mutton and lamb, so let's replace them with sheep. And so this notorious agent of his, Patrick Feller, would go out with a group of tough-looking Highlanders and quite literally boot these hapless tenants who had lived blamelessly on these tiny little patches of land and paid rent to the Duke for years previously, and booted them off the land, and they were replaced by sheep. And the Duke felt, as he said, somewhat guilty. So he said, well, I'll build them a little town, and they can learn how to fish. And so he built them a town called Helmsdale, full of little cottages, and said, you can go and live there. And they said, we know nothing about fishing. We wouldn't know one end of a fish from another. We can't swim. We don't know anything about the sea. So they, one particular group I'm thinking of, as it were, saw a passing freighter and got it to stop. It crossed the Atlantic. It was taking migrants to Hudson Bay, way up in northern Canada. Those who survived, and a lot didn't, got off the boat and trekked up the Red River in winter and finally exhausted, settled down and founded Winnipeg. And one of them, his grandson, turned out to be John Diefenbaker, one of the early Canadian prime ministers. So the consequences of enclosure in England and clearances in Scotland were worldwide. And interestingly, the man who perpetrated it in Scotland, this first Duke of Sutherland, I knew that there was a statue raised to him as memorial. I was up there with my son researching for this book. We couldn't find it anywhere. So we sort of gave up and were driving back south, and there was a range of hills on the horizon. And all we could see on the range of hills was a radio aerial. And Rupert said to me, my son, after about 20 miles, as the radio aerial grew bigger and bigger, he said, that's not a radio aerial. That is a statue, 200 feet tall in red sandstone. People have been trying to blow it up ever since, but they've failed. And so it stands there, a statue of an Englishman who did nothing but clear Scotsmen off their lands and persuaded an awful lot of them to go to places like Canada.
Simon Winchester. We'll talk more with him about his latest book, Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World, after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like special segments and extended interviews. Let's continue our conversation with Simon Winchester about his latest book, Land. He tells us about new experiments in collective ownership of land and what that could mean for us. And Simon Winchester, you also kind of update the story of land ownership in Scotland. Talk about the island of Ulva and the growth of the movement for community ownership of land.
I find this utterly fascinating. I mean, when I was I used to be a geologist and I used to go to Scotland a lot on field trips and became aware of, not least because I dated one of the actresses, of a theatre company called the 784 Theatre Company. And it was a sort of radical left-wing theatre company arguing, among other things, for a redistribution of Scottish land because, as they said, 7% of the people own 84% of the land.
Say that again. How many?
It was called the 784 Theatre Company because 7% of the people owned 84% of the land. And the Duke being a classic example, I mean, he owned thousands upon thousands of acres. So they sought to reverse this. They didn't have a great deal of success. until quite recently when Scotland became quasi-independent. And this new Scottish government, led by this lady who's in the news at the moment for different reasons, Nicola Sturgeon, said land must no longer be, or at least we must introduce policies that stop individual landowners from owning large tracts of land. And this came dramatically into focus for me recently. I used to live on an island in Scotland and came to know one neighbour island called Ulva quite well. It was owned, it was very small, it was mostly farms, and there was a decent manor house, as it were, the big house, owned by a family called Howard, Jamie Howard. Well, for a variety of reasons, Jamie decided about 5 years ago he was going to sell up and move. He entirely personal reasons, he didn't want to stay. So he put it on, he advertised 5,000 acre island with a nice house and a number of farms for sale on the west coast of Scotland in the fancy magazines, the Scottish Field and so forth, and a huge amount of interest, as you might suppose, mainly from rich Americans or rich Russians. And helicopters would come in and land, and he'd show them the island, a completely beautiful place. And I think the asking price was about £4 million, about $6 million. He was about to consummate a deal when suddenly, at a conference of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, who had said land in Scotland must henceforward not be owned by private individuals, said, "We're not going to give permission for this sale to go ahead because Mr. Howard can sell his land, but before any individual tries to buy it, a community can be formed to buy it for the community." And so, very hastily, a quote, community, unquote, was formed. About 60 people, not all of them Scots, not all of them living anywhere near Ulva, formed a community and said, "Right, we've formed ourselves. We'd like to bid £4 million for this island." And the government said, "Okay, you can, and we will provide you from the Scottish Land Fund £3.5 million, close to the purchase price, to help you buy it." So all they had to do was to find, you know, effectively a GoFundMe campaign, £500,000, and now they're the owners. And so Jamie Howard got his money, and he's now living in the south of France. And the community wrote to me just last week saying that all the farms are being refurbished, new structures are being built, the big house is being turned into something different, a sort of an environmental centre, and part of Scotland is no longer belonging to one person, but is now belonging to many. And this movement is happening with government support, one might say government pressure, all over Scotland. So soon the 784 number that I quoted at the beginning will no longer be relevant anymore. Scotland will at long last, for good or ill, be owned by communities rather than by individuals.
Well, you know, it strikes me that in a world where land is increasingly, the habitability of land is increasingly being threatened by climate change, where huge migrations are on the move, perhaps a new sense of what ownership means is in order.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's a fascinating thought, and it is, the green shoots of it, to use a cliche, are beginning to be shown. This is altogether another subject in a way, and that's the notion of trespass, which is very much, once again, and I don't mean to lambaste America, I live here, I love this country, but the idea that once you own land, one of the so-called bundle of rights you have is you have the right to exclude anyone from it. You can put up barbed wire being invented in America, as it happens, fences, and just keep out signs and not allow anyone to be on your land. This concept is completely abhorrent in most countries in Scandinavia, for instance. The concept in Sweden, known as allemansrätten, all men's right, means that every Swede has an absolute right in law, so long as he behaves properly, wander about on any land, no matter who owns it. And now this is spread from Norway, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, to Scotland. Now, I have a friend who lives very close to Dunrobin Castle that I mentioned earlier, the Duke of Sutherland's estates, and he owns 22,000 acres. He's a farmer, so some is forest, some is deer, some is sheep, some is cattle, and there's a stream fishing on the Helmsdale River. It used to be that he could exclude people. I mean, a very kind man, he didn't exclude people, but in law, he had the right to. Now, because the law has changed and is somewhat similar to the Scandinavian all men's right, he will see people. I mean, when we were there together, there were people camping and there were people walking. And I said, did they ask permission? No, he said. They don't need to ask permission. They, so long as they behave, they can't dig huge holes or set off fireworks or scare the cattle, they can be there. And I, this friend of mine, Michael Wigan, said, absolutely, I'm entirely in favour of it. Why didn't we think of it before? Land belongs to us all. It is our mother. We are here to superintend it, to love it. It helps us. We should help it. And the common ownership advances that kind of thinking, in my view anyway.
And the book is Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. We're talking with author Simon Winchester. And then finally, you also talk about the idea of rewilding. I mean, there is the concept that if we are to survive as a species, we need to rewild the earth. We need to give half the earth back to nature, basically. You talk about places like the DMZ between North and South Korea. You talk about Chernobyl. You also talk about a place that I've been to, the Pleistocene Park that's in Flevoland near Lelystad, where in Holland, on land that was reclaimed from the Zuider Zee. Talk about the idea of rewilding. I mean, you know, you don't give it the highest marks, but tell us a little bit about it, and what do you think of the idea that we need to kind of expand the idea of ownership beyond the human?
It's become very popular, particularly in Britain at the moment, largely because of a couple called Charlie Burrell and Isabella Tree, who live in a pretty large estate, a place called Knepp Parcel, just south of London. And they were arable farmers, not particularly successful in the 1970s and 80s, 3,500 acres, I think. And they decided that they would stop trying to make a living out of farming this, but they would let it rewild itself to go back to what it used to be, to recreate, if you like, medieval England with all the animals and birds and plants that used to have been there, but which had been purged by fertilizers and by intensive farming to make way for the kind of meadows that cattle like to eat the grass off to produce milk or beef or whatever. So they did that, and it has become a phenomenon, and they've written books about it, and there have been television programs about it, and it's now visited by many people, and there are glamping sites and so forth, glamorized camping sites, people basking in the possibility of seeing some horse that hadn't existed in England for 1,000 years, but which has been reintroduced from Poland or wherever such horses exist today, and spotting birds that have long become otherwise extinct or diminished in England generally. And it's a fine idea. The similar thing that happened and that you saw in Flevoland in Holland was actually a disaster because there was a terrible winter and the animals starved and it didn't work very well. This is working pretty well, but do we need it to be such a she-she tourist attraction? I look from my window now in Western Massachusetts at land that was once farmed by largely Ukrainian Jewish migrants. They went off to more benign climatically benign parts of America or down to New York City. And the stone walls that they erected in the 1880s, 1890s are generally crumbling. And second, third growth forest has enveloped them now. And the field patterns have more or less, but not entirely, disappeared. And all the animals and birds that used to be here before their farming techniques frightened them away are coming back. And obviously deer, but I see from my window, I can see moose, I see mountain lions, I can see all kinds of porcupines and opossums. In fact, a possum went into my chicken house the other day. Basically, this is natural rewilding as opposed to artificial rewilding. No tourist is going to come here. And I welcome that. I like the thought that nature is reclaiming this part of the land without any assistance from humankind. I mean, what I find, chemicals, GMO, vast factory farms, that is awful. I think we all accept that. The impact on the prairies and so forth, and the terrible damage that's being done to the environment. But here the environment is coming back into its own, naturally, not artificially, and that I applaud.
That's true. And actually, we've talked with Isabella Tree here on Writer's Voice, and I visited that Pleistocene Park before it went so terribly wrong in that bitter winter. Many thousands of animals died because the Dutch government would not allow feeding, because they said this was, you know, that would be counter to the idea of a natural experiment. There's so much more in this wonderful book, Simon Winchester, Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. I mean, we didn't even talk about mapping and measuring and manifest destiny, or the creation of land in the Netherlands, which is a whole amazing story in itself. But I will leave that to our listeners to read further when they get your book. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thank you very much indeed for having me.
Simon Winchester. You can hear an excerpt from Land, read by the author, by going to writersvoice.net. Now, let's hear an excerpt from my 2020 interview with Isabella Tree, author of Wilding, The Return of Nature to a British Farm. After a short introduction, you'll hear how wildlife, including species that are rare and endangered, have returned to NEP, the estate Tree and her husband own. When Isabella Tree and her husband Charlie took over management of Charlie's family's farm, NEP, they tried to make a go with modern intensive farming practices. But the heavy clay soil fought back, and the couple ended up heavily in debt. So, in the year 2000, they tried something different, very different. They gave up farming and let the land go wild. Within a short period of time, they were seeing species that hadn't been seen in England in many decades. Managed with minimal human intervention and with herds of free-roaming animals driving the creation of new habitats, their rewilded land is now heaving with life. Rare species like turtle doves, nightingales, peregrine falcons, and purple emperor butterflies are now breeding at NEP, and biodiversity has rocketed.
Suddenly, we began to look at the soil and what we were doing to the soil as farmers in a completely different way. And I think that's the moment we started on this journey of kind of turning around approach to what we were doing to the land.
And very much that turning around, well, it did involve some work on your part, but it was work that encouraged nature itself to do its thing. Tell us just a little bit about some of the first things that you did and how quickly you began to see some species come that are actually endangered or in decline in other places in the UK.
I think that was one of the most astonishing things. We originally, when we embarked on the rewilding project, we hoped that if we could increase biodiversity just a little, that would have been an experiment worth taking. But as it was, you know, we've just been astounded by the rebound of nature. It just shows that given half a chance, nature will bounce back. We've now got all five UK species of owls. We've got 13 out of the 17 breeding species of bat, including two bats, Bechstein and Barbasol bat, which are so rare, they're rare even in Europe. We've got some of our rarest birds, including the nightingale, which is critically in decline. And the bird that's most likely to go extinct from Britain in the next 10 years or so is the turtle dove. And we now have 20 singing males on NEP last summer. And we know they're breeding because we've been able to ring a few fledglings. So we're probably the only place in Britain now where there are breeding numbers, rising numbers of turtle doves, which is just astonishing. We've got so many red data species, endangered species that, I mean, you know, I could go on listing them. But what's astounded us is not just the rarity of the birds that are coming back, but also the biomass, the sheer volume of life that's out there now. So that's changing the way that scientists think about what the land is capable of holding. When you go out on a spring day in the early morning and listen to the dawn chorus, the bird song is so loud that it just reverberates in your stomach. It's quite astounding.
Yes, it is. You know, something that I've noticed over the last couple of decades, it used to be that when I went out in my car, I'd always have to clean my windshield. And I haven't had to clean my windshield of insects for a very, very long time. And then a few years ago, we learned why, which is that 75% of the insects have disappeared. 30% of the birds have disappeared. You have seen an amazing resurgence of insects coming back in a very short period of time. And they are the basis of the food chain.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing we noticed first of all, was that very first summer that we walked out of the doors after we'd committed to rewilding, was the sound of the insects. It was something we hadn't even known as farmers that we'd been missing. And now we have, as you say, we have that moth snowstorm. We have to put our windscreen wipers on, you know, if we're driving at night, because of the insects splattering on the windscreen again. It's something that I hadn't known since I was a child in the 1960s. If you're cycling out there in the summer, you have to put on sunglasses because you get thwacked in the eyeball with insects. That's how it used to be. And we've completely forgotten that. And it's, of course, because of the insects that, you know, we have some of these amazing birds coming back. And the bats, of course, are feasting on these burgeoning populations of insects. But it's not just the flying insects. It's also really important keystone species like dung beetles. Mm-hmm. So obviously now we're not putting wormers and antibiotics into the livestock anymore. Everything out there is purely organic. So we have all this organic dung from our free-roaming animals, from our old English longhorns, from the Exmoor ponies, from the red deer and the fallow deer, and even our Tamworth pigs. And that is proving a feast for dung beetles. And of course, dung beetles pull down the dung into the soil to make chambers for their larvae. And that is a fantastic way of returning nutrients and soil structure. My husband's turned into a bit of a dung beetle fetishist, and I couldn't work out what he was doing the other day. He was following the cattle, and every time one of them did a cowpat, he would drop to his stomach next to the cowpat, and with his mobile phone. And I couldn't work out what he was doing, but he was timing how long it took the dung beetles to find that cowpat. And I think the record was 60 seconds. That's how fast they find it. And then he started kind of doing experiments in the kitchen, which wasn't quite so popular, looking at how many dung beetles he could find in the cowpat. And he found 23 different species of dung beetle in a single cowpat, including one dung beetle, the violet door beetle, which hasn't been seen in Sussex for 50 years. So that's the astonishing thing. These creatures are clinging on to little scraps, tiny fragments of habitat out there in the landscape. And as soon as they find us and the habitat is right for them, then the populations explode.
That was Isabella Tree talking with Writer's Voice in 2020 about her book, Wilding. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. Next week for Earth Day, we talk with novelist Elliot Pepper about his climate crisis thriller, Vail. Don't miss it. And here's an announcement. On Earth Day, April 22nd, Discovery Channel will air a special 2-hour preview of A Perfect Planet. It's a 5-part series from Sir David Attenborough. The Discovery Channel will also air a marathon of the Emmy-nominated series Serengeti. So those are a couple of things to watch on Earth Day from the Discovery Channel. And in fact, the channel is going to be devoting the entire month of April to a full slate of natural history programming. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.